Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
He's got advisors, speechwriters, pollsters, trusted friends, and his wife Michelle to guide him in his State of the Union address. And now he also has Kevin from Baltimore.
What is Obama going to say tomorrow? He can't say too much because, bottom line, Obama let the Republicans run him over. And he should, I know he's trying to be a nice guy and do another thing, but guess what? He should have called him out, and he need to call him out tomorrow night.
Talk radio callers call in about Obama calling out. You're on the air. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, January 27th, and the takeaway is, if there's a lot of frustration with Washington out there, is Obama putting out a fire tonight, or is he igniting that frustration with his State of the Union speech?
And which would be the better strategy? Another good question. But let's get right to the top stories this morning. In his first State of the Union address tonight, President Obama will try to reassure a recession-weary nation that better days are ahead for the economy. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs says that'll be the main topic tonight.
The president will talk about ensuring that we begin to get our fiscal house in order.
Here's the latest on the speech. As of this morning, we know the president will call for a boost in education spending and a change in the way that student loans are guaranteed. He'll also outline a new response plan to bioterrorism attacks, as well as accept responsibility, though not the blame, for failing to deliver on his first-year campaign promises.
So that's what the president is expected to say tonight, but there's mounting frustration across the country on whether he can actually deliver. Of course, that's evidenced by the result in Massachusetts more than a week ago. And we're joined by Mark Steiner, host of The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA in Baltimore. Mark, you know, it seems to me that frustration with Washington is something of the lifeblood of talk radio. Now, you'd never want to mess with that, would you?
It helps on talk radio, but the real issue is that I would say that a majority of my listeners across a racial and class spectrum, and they really do, who voted for Obama, and the majority of those listeners now are really frustrated with where the country is going, and I was taken aback by the amount of people who were really saying, please, President Obama, step up to the plate and do something strong and hard for us to fight for us. And that's the general tenor, I find, of most of our listeners.
Well, we're going to talk about this in a minute in more detail, but would you say that that frustration is a kind of fuel that the Obama presidency can use, or is it more a headwind that's slowing him down?
No, I think it's a fuel he can use. It depends on what they think their political strategy is, but I think that if this is the fuel that put him over the top in the election that made him president, it's the same fuel he could use to get his agenda done, much like President Reagan did. The question is whether he'll do it. I don't know, and I think our listeners are all waiting, as we say, with bated breath to find out.
Yes, indeed. That is the suspense. We're going to talk about that agenda and how to mobilize frustration in America in the State of the Union address in just a moment.
Its analysts are calling Toyota's move unprecedented. It's suspending U.S. sales of 8 of its most popular models, including the Camry and the Corolla, while it works to fix faulty gas pedals. Toyota is also planning to stop production at 6 North American plants starting next week. The news is better for GM. The company finally found a buyer for Saab after signing a deal with the small Dutch automaker Spyker Cars. That deal was signed yesterday.
In Haiti, 45% of the population are children. We can remind you of that. Thousands were made orphans by the earthquake. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill are working on legislation to streamline the system for bringing Haitian orphans to the U.S. 500 orphans have arrived since the disaster. In London, they're talking about Yemen. Tomorrow, it'll be a broad conference on the future of Afghanistan. Here at home, voters in Oregon have voted to raise taxes on businesses and people who earn more than six figures a year. Asian and European markets are down. Futures are mixed. The Dow gets underway at 10,194. The S&P opens at 1,092. And the NASDAQ starts at 2203.
All morning long, we're asking you to give your own brief State of the Union address for us. What do you think is the state of our union in six words or so? Tell us at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it on our site, thetakeaway.org. Wait, later this hour, we'll ask that question to Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty. And in a few minutes, we'll find out what people have been saying with talk show hosts from around the country.
Mark Steiner and more. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
So Obama is going to be speaking. The president will be delivering his first State of the Union address tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern. But up until that time, and really all week long, other Americans have been speaking on talk radio about what the president will say. We already heard from Kevin, who spoke yesterday in Baltimore.
What is Obama going to say tomorrow? He can't say too much because, bottom line, Obama let the Republicans run him over. And he should. I know he's trying to be a nice guy and do another thing, but guess what? He should have called him out, and he need to call him out tomorrow night.
I'm a community organizer here on the north side of Chicago, and a lot of people out there in Chicago are saying they're for Barack. They know that Barack has only been there for 1 year, but they have seen the banking corporation get so much bailout that they feel that it's time for the American people, the middle class, and the poor people.
So there's nothing scientific about those two voices, Kevin and Dan, one in Baltimore, one in Chicago. But a lot of politicians believe the frustration that both are talking about is an integer in politics right now, a measurable phenomenon that Barack Obama is going to have to deal with tonight. And we want to talk about that with three talk show hosts around the country. Bev Smith is the host of The Bev Smith Show, syndicated on American Urban Radio Network. She joins us from Pittsburgh. Good morning, Bev.
Good morning.
Mark Steiner, we just spoke with. He's the host of the Mark Steiner Show on WEAA in Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning again, Mark.
Good morning.
And Ray Hanania, host of Mornings with Ray Hanania on WJJG in Chicago, where Dan, who you just heard a moment ago, called into. Ray, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
So to all three of you, there's nothing scientific about talk radio. They're aficionados and kind of a very special subgroup that call into your shows. There's no reason for me to ever take the voices on your talk radio shows as emblematic of anything going on in America. Bev Smith, prove me wrong.
I'm just shocked by your statement. my listening audience would disagree with you emphatically, because it is the voice of America speaking, and these are the people that don't get polled by the various polling systems, and they are workers and teachers and lawyers and mothers and fathers and young people in college. And they have a lot to say about what's going on, and they don't like it. What they're hoping for tonight is that the president will talk about unemployment, that he will return to the domestic program that was shot to hell by the Bush administration and Reagan's leftovers on Capitol Hill. And they really are praying that the president will say something about America tonight as he talks about the international scene.
Right.
So my audience is as astute and as bright as any politician on Capitol Hill, and that's despite the fact that they voted for some of them.
All right, Bev Smith, I'm bruised and bleeding. Mark Steiner, can you take me down?
You know, I think that people look at talk radio sometimes as a very ideological forum, but I really think that, especially in the public media where I am, that this audience represents a real cross-section of Maryland from all sectors. And it's not just the call-ins. It's people I get on Facebook. It's the emails. It's conversations when I'm going to get a cup of coffee somewhere around town. That people are very frustrated. And I think the frustration is of the Obama voters themselves who think there's a line in this country, and they want to fight for their vision of America, and they don't feel that President Barack Obama is leading that fight, and they want him to do it.
Ray Hanania, is that what you're hearing in Barack Obama's hometown there of Chicago? And your audience is unusual. Describe it for me.
Well, we broadcast to a mainstream Chicagoland area that includes many Arabs and Muslims. Because I happen to be Arab, I draw a lot of those Arabs and Muslims, you know, to one of the only radio programs they can really identify with. So I get to hear both sides. I hear Americans talk about the issues of health care, you know, the economy, jobs, the battle between Republicans and Democrats. And then on top of it, I listen to Arabs and Muslims talk about how President Obama really disappointed him, that he set the bar too high, that maybe he didn't understand the difficulties, you know, of the Middle East. You know, was he talking to the Muslim world, or was he talking to the Arab world? You know, was he concerned about resolving the Middle East conflict or undermining extremists in the Islamic world? And I'll say that it's interesting when you bring those two groups together on one radio show, and we do it once a week. We simulcast in Dearborn. You get some interesting responses from both sides, but Barack Obama is always one of our main topics that callers want to bring up and want to talk about.
All right. So that's Ray Hanania, host of Mornings with Ray Hanania, a radio show in Chicago. Mark Steiner, host of the Mark Steiner Show in Baltimore, public radio show. And Bev Smith, host of a syndicated talk show, The Bev Smith Show, out of Pittsburgh. So, Bev, do your listeners think that Barack Obama has sort of miscalculated by trying to do too much in the first year, or that he's been co-opted in some sense?
They're mixed. But for the most part, what we're puzzled about is that all of a sudden the problems in America became the problems that this president created, as opposed to the 8 years of the Bush administration. And we don't understand why the president is being blamed for the conditions that he has, and why mainstream media is concentrating on his term. We call him the cleanup man. And it is not easy, as most of you know, to clean up after someone. Just try cleaning up after your two-year-old. It's not easy. And so we think that the president did have some very clever opinions about what should be done, and that's not even the word I'm looking for. We think that he thought that he could accomplish a lot, but he forgot that he was dealing with the same people that caused the problems. And that's what has my audience puzzled, totally puzzled, why people are so willing not to give this president a chance when they gave Bush 8 years and he destroyed this country, and this man cannot do it in 12 years.
All right, Ray Hanania, are you hearing that sort of a right-wing conspiracy or a Republican mess that is going to be very difficult to clean up in your listeners?
Well, I think the real irony here is that Obama is familiar to us. He comes from Chicago. We've always recognized he's an inspiring speaker, but when you look at his record of achievements, it's always been very tough. The big word I hear here, one of the biggest, is they want him to be tougher and they want him to deliver, and they don't feel he's done that.
Wow. Mark Steiner, before we go, we asked Doris Kearns Goodwin yesterday to give us a State of the Union in 6 words. You know, she writes very long, fabulous books.
Yes, she does.
It's even scarier to ask that of a radio talk show host. Can you give me a State of the Union in 6 words?
In 6 words, we are going to take on the special interests and the corporations, and we're going to start doing things for the American people and not Wall Street.
That's 15 words, but well done there.
I tried. Mark Steiner. I tried.
Mark Steiner,
I tried.
Host of the Mark Steiner Show on WEA in Baltimore. We also talked with Bev Smith of the Bev Smith Show in Pittsburgh, and Ray Hanania, host of Mornings with Ray in Chicago. All right, at 15 minutes after the hour, we're following the headlines. Celeste?
Job creation and the economy are expected to be the main topics in President Obama's first State of the Union address tonight. He'll also touch on ways to deal with bioterror attacks and on lifting the ban on gays in the military. We want to give you a chance to weigh in on these issues. What are your 6 words to describe the state of our union, or just the state of anything in the country?
My name is Bob Nee. I'm calling from Boston. I wish Ted Kennedy had lived.
So maybe it's on Obama or on health care or something else. Tell us what you think at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post it at our website, thetakeaway.org. Remember that number, too, because we want to get your takes on his State of the Union address after you've heard it. The $1.3 trillion national debt will also be on tonight's docket. Yesterday, a plan for a bipartisan task force to address the debt failed in the Senate, but the president's expected to establish his own panel by executive order.
So, moving to Haiti, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had some strong words for those in the international community who have criticized U.S. relief efforts in Haiti.
I deeply resent those who attack our country, the generosity of our people, and the leadership of our president in trying to respond to historically disastrous conditions.
Clinton was responding to an Italian official who said the U.S. military wasn't doing enough. Tough economic times seem to have sparked more volunteerism in the U.S. The Bureau of Labor Statistics say 1.5 million more Americans volunteered last year than the year before, and a milestone for James Cameron. The director's Avatar has passed Titanic. It's now the biggest box office hit of all time. Let's look at some of the stories we're following this morning.
Hey, you want that to go?
A couple of news takeouts now. We begin in Washington with Todd Zwillick, Takeaway's Washington correspondent. From the nation's capital, there is shrieking and moaning about the deficit, but the Senate wanted nothing to do with a deficit commission yesterday. Todd, what's up with that?
Yeah, it went down in flames, John. 53 votes they got for it. They, of course, would have needed 60 as it goes in the Senate. You're right. The Senate just doesn't have any interest in ceding any of its power to a commission that would have ordered it to vote on deficit reduction and get serious. And a lot of the Democrats, the liberals in Congress, say this is just an excuse to cut Social Security, and we're not going to give anyone that authority. Leaves us right where we started. No clear way to do some serious deficit reduction. What? You know, they want to cut this discretionary spending, but that's a tiny part of the budget. So it's unclear where they're going from here, I think.
What's the track record on commissions weighing in on something that Congress is actually supposed to do?
Not great. There was a commission a few years ago called BRAC. It was the Base Realignment and Closing Commission. You know, after the Cold War, we had all these bases all over the country, military bases, wasting money. They're so politicized, we needed to close them. You can't rely on members of Congress to say, sure, close the military base in my district. You know, who's going to want to do that?
Right.
They assigned a commission to do it. The commission made recommendations. People stuck to it, and they closed a lot of bases and saved a lot of money. It's the only one people think really worked.
And so a blue ribbon commission or a task force on the deficit is probably going nowhere, even though the president might speak about that in his speech tonight. One of the mysteries I want you to resolve, is there any sense of what Obama is going to say about where health care goes next?
Well, he needs to say something, and members of Congress really need him to say something. I want to give you a little bit of illustration here from the halls of Congress yesterday, John. The House and the Senate seem to be not, the right hand and the left hand don't know what the other's doing right now. Listen to Steny Hoyer. He's the House Majority Leader. We're asking him, hey, what's the plan? Are you guys moving forward on health care or not? Listen to Steny Hoyer.
I think by next week we need to come to focus on the way we want to move forward.
You really nailed him down there, Todd.
Well, that's the House. He says by next week we need to come to a plan. Now listen to Senator Dianne Feinstein on her way out of a meeting of the Democratic caucus yesterday.
Look, it's January. This session goes to the end of the year. We have time. There is so much hyperbole out there. I think it's got to die down, simmer down. I think cooler minds and heads have to prevail.
That is so different from the rhetoric a couple of months ago. It's almost like, mellow out, we're going to do some health care.
It's so different. But you hear the House saying by next week we're gonna have a plan of how we're going to pass this bill. The Senate says we have until the end of the year. Everybody relax. The president does need to talk about health care tonight. He needs to give members of Congress his direction about where they're going to go. They're going to buckle down and pass this thing or find a way to pass it, or, as Feinstein says, everybody relax, let cooler heads prevail, and we can pass it, you know, sometime next October. I think they're relying on the president to tie him down and tell him where to go.
All right, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks for that.
And for our next takeout,
there's no way that I can express to you what I'm feeling right now except to say I'm the king of the world!
Okay, so if film director James Cameron was king of the world after Titanic, what is he now? He's ultra supreme, uber commander of the world. Because what's just happened is in 5 short weeks, the director's newest feature film, Avatar, has broken the Titanic box office record that he set. A studio exec said yesterday Avatar has pulled in $1.859 billion worldwide. That's more than the GDPs. Get this, it's more than GDPs of entire countries like Belize and Greenland. Here to talk about the business of blockbusting, Tom Geyer. He's the senior editor at Entertainment Weekly. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
Cameron's finished. That's it for him.
That guy's going nowhere. Does this make Tom? Does this make James Cameron the best director ever in the history of film?
I don't know about the best director. He's certainly the loudest in proclaiming his own talents these days. But, you know, this is a huge achievement. It's worth bearing in mind, though, that ticket prices have increased rather significantly. And in terms of domestic box office, Avatar is really just number 26 when you adjust the ticket prices for inflation.
Oh, interesting.
That's good to know.
Yeah, so, you know.
He just passed Thunderball. Woohoo!
A James Bond film.
Nice way to take away his thunder there, Tom Geyer of Entertainment Weekly. But, you know, what does this mean about the future of movie making? Is everybody going to be trying to, like, top that record?
Certainly Hollywood is a place where records tend not to stand for very long. And I think what we're going to see is a lot of studios rolling out 3D epics in the Avatar scale. Now, maybe not quite on the scale of Avatar, but certainly 3D is a way to boost your box office revenues. You can charge about $3 or $4 more per ticket, and that has a great deal to do with Avatar's success here.
Right.
Close to 70% of their revenues are coming from 3D screens.
Wow. Well, but Tom Geyer, isn't it fair to say, all those kind of games aside, that Cameron rightly can take the place of, say, Spielberg, who really transformed the movie-going experience with movies like E.T., that he's sort of a Spielberg for this era?
I think that is fair to say. I mean, Cameron certainly has transformed audience expectations of what big screen entertainment is. And getting people into the theaters again when there's so many opportunities to sort of observe these movies at home and home theaters, and but the movie-going experience, the movie theater experience, has really gotten a shot in the arm, and thanks to Avatar and James Cameron.
So maybe this is good news of a turnaround in the movie business. You know, it hasn't been that long since they were talking about declining revenues at box offices and saying where is Hollywood going? They can't make any money in the theaters anymore. Is this good news?
I think it is good news. Hollywood Studios had a record year last year. Some of that was due to ticket price increases, but a lot of it was also due to the studios actually getting their act together and producing movies that people wanted to see and were willing to...
Memo to GM, make a good product, people will buy it.
Shocking news, yes.
Tim Geyer is Tim Geyer is the senior editor at Entertainment Weekly, talking about the newly christened super ultra...
King, emperor of the
ultimate
world. Yeah. King of
emperor,
the universe.
Tyrant of all world. I
Avatar
don't know.
Rules.
What title can you possibly give him now? Rich.
Yeah, there you go.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, coming out of Haiti, not just tragic stories of those who passed away, but also stories of lucky survival by the skin of their teeth. Some people made it out. We're going to hear one of those stories in just a few moments. First, here's some of the stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is attending an international conference in London, where today they're looking at the risk posed by terrorists in Yemen and how to deal with those risks. Tomorrow, the focus will be Afghanistan. Speaking this morning, Special Envoy Richard Holbrook says the U.S. will support Afghan President Hamid Karzai's plan to reintegrate Taliban fighters. The idea is to convince low and mid-level Taliban soldiers who don't back al-Qaeda to give up their fight against NATO forces. Earlier on The Takeaway, Fatina Christia, a professor of political science at MIT, told us more about that plan.
They basically expect a good Taliban to self-select into this program by structuring the incentives in a way that makes sense for them to join.
The plan is the centerpiece of the London conference designed to boost the flagging war effort in Afghanistan, where U.S. and NATO forces have been taking increasing casualties from resurgent Taliban forces.
We'll ask how things are going in Afghanistan when we talk later today with David Petraeus, the general in charge of the CENTCOM, Central Command, and we will broadcast that interview tomorrow on The Takeaway. President Obama's first State of the Union is tonight. His address is going to be given at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs says the president will try to convince Americans he's got a plan to turn the economy around, but it won't be easy.
We are not going to be able to get to the top of that mountain unless we can start and continue to climb up it from the base.
A few things we know about the speech already this morning. The president will propose programs for education and middle-class families, as well as a spending freeze on some domestic programs and an end to the ban on gays in the military. We want to give you a chance to weigh in on all this. What's your six words to describe the State of the Union or the state of Obama's job performance? 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it at our website, thetakeaway.org. And comments on the speech at those locations as well. Let's check in on the markets. Asian and European markets are down, futures up. The Dow gets underway at 10,194, the S&P opens at 1,092, and the NASDAQ at 2203. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Staggering numbers coming out of Haiti. Already 150,000 bodies have been recovered, but it's estimated that 200,000 are dead and 194,000 more injured. But amid those hundreds of thousands of casualties, there are also stories that have yet to be told about survival. And we're going to hear one of those stories now. Gaba Ororo was in Port-au-Prince on the day the earthquake struck. He was working for the United Nations peacekeeping mission there. But Gabo is lucky enough to be in New York right now, where he lives when he's not on assignment in the Haitian capital. Gabo, where were you when the earthquake hit?
Well, I'd come back, and I had a compensation day for working on Christmas, so I was at the gym. I was at the gym in Pétionville, which is kind of the expat community hip bohemian Greenwich Village of Port-au-Prince. And so I happened to be there waiting for my spinning class, absurdly enough.
But if you'd been at the UN that day, you probably wouldn't have survived.
Yeah, we lost about most people in our team. I work in the basement in kind of a control unit that deals with the situational awareness and security and political briefings for the heads of missions. So, yeah, we lost people. And some people were buried in rubble. I have a good friend, and she was buried in the rubble for about 18 hours and made it out, but though she might be paralyzed or there might be some other problems. But
so yeah. What did you have? Your home was destroyed, mm-hmm. your workplace was destroyed, and you were at the gym. I know what I bring to the gym. What did you have with you?
I went there in a pair of jeans and sneakers and a T-shirt and just my shorts and a jump rope, and I didn't even have my passport.
So how did you get out? How did you end up getting out of Haiti?
Well, I was told I waited all day in the embassy there, and they were unable, the flights didn't come because there was a lack of coordination in the airport. And I was told to go to the airport the next morning. I went to the airport, and there's about 1,000 or probably, I can't estimate, but like maybe 500 to 1,000, for lack of a better word, people who look Haitian but have blue passports in their hands. They're American. And here's me, you know, trying to figure out how to get into this airport without a passport when there's no line, there's no coordination. And so I saw some media, thankfully, and, you know, I took out my UN badge and had to play that kind of privileged card that I guess some people can play, which is tough, but when you have to survive, that's what comes out. And I snuck into the airport, and you see, you know, the U.S. embassy officials who are, just have their jaw to the ground, don't really know, like, what to do, you know, given that these are all Americans, too, you know. And then I was told that there was no planes, but there might be a plane, and there might be all these things. And so I went on the tarmac, and you see the Marines, you see different coordinates. It's a circus. It's a kaleidoscope of, like, suffering and aid and the Marines. And basically, I went on the tarmac, and I saw a plane that was empty, that was a private jet with some Dominicans. I speak Spanish. I talked to them, and they offered me a ride out, and I drove alone in luxury, bizarrely enough, through that chaos into the Dominican Republic.
And where did they fly you?
To the Santo Domingo. And I didn't have a passport or anything, and they were like, it's a local airport, and then they helped me. And when I got to immigration, I happened to have my UN ID card, and I think that helped me.
To get back to New York.
Yeah, to get back. And to then the embassy there helped me, and I was able to get back from there.
So are you done with Haiti?
I need to really properly assess the risk and figure out some of the working conditions in order to do it. And I think that's slowly becoming more apparent. And I think I'd make a decision in a couple of weeks of how to go back effectively. Because right now I'm going through some medical treatment because I picked up some dysentery. And so I'm
that
just...
That sounds great.
Yeah.
But you would go back.
I would go back. I think if I'm not a liability, and I think given what my job is, I think it's very important to go back and to go back meaningfully in coordinated effort with some sort of provisions. What was there when I left was impossible because I think most of the people who had to leave, like myself, were people who had lost everything and people who really needed to just go back to regroup to then go back in a meaningful way where they're not necessarily a liability.
That's you. You've lost everything there.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet you'd still want to go back to a country which you acknowledge is going to be ravaged by disease. It's going to take months and months and months to rebuild. They're about to have to deal with rainstorms. Then the hurricane season is coming.
Yeah, yeah. But it's kind of the nature of the work when you go into it, that you have to assume that you have these ups and downs. And I think it's kind of, if we're properly in a basic way taken care of, where we have one meal a day even, or a shower, and a bed, which wasn't there when I left, that they're able to organize that for some of the workers. I think this is why you go into this field. I think this is why you do what you do. But I think the problem is you need to assure that you at least have that and at least have something, because otherwise it can just become a lot more problematic. And I think that's what they're trying to arrange. I heard that in the New York Times and also through my sources that there might be a tent city for certain workers so that they can provide, you know, shower and sanitation and other things. But I think this is why we do what we do. I mean, this is what's important. This is why it's important. If we don't do it, who's going to do it? I don't know. And it is an impossible situation. I don't think months. I think years, I can't even get my head around it. That's the harder part, you know. You just don't know, like, what's the way forward in, with a lot of these things, because it just seems like complete chaos and destruction. I mean, but I think someone has to do it.
Well, it sounds like that someone is Gabo Arora. He's in New York now trying to regroup after losing everything in the earthquake in Haiti. He was with the UN peacekeeping mission there when the earthquake struck Port-au-Prince. Thanks so much, Gabo. All morning, we're looking for your reactions to President Obama's address tonight. What do you think is the state of our union? In six words, we want to hear from you. Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or post on our website, thetakeaway.org. Tomorrow after the speech, we're going to talk to General David Petraeus and get his reaction. And later in the hour today, we'll ask Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry.
When we speak of America's priorities, the first priority must always be peace for America and the world.
It is a long line that President Barack Obama joins tonight in his first State of the Union address. His 43 predecessors have used the constitutionally mandated message to take credit, to lay blame, float trial balloons, announce causes and initiatives. LBJ made this promise back in 1967.
We should outlaw all wiretapping, public and private, whenever it occurs, except when the security of this nation itself is at stake.
Picking up that security theme nearly 40 years later, George W. Bush had this famous line in 2002.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world. By seeking weapons of mass destruction, these regimes pose a grave and growing danger.
Can you name the axis of evil nations? Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. But you may have had to think. A lot of State of the Union speechmaking feels perishable. It doesn't stick in the brain. For instance, can you name the biggest applause line in Jimmy Carter's 1979 State of the Union speech?
We remain committed to improving our labor laws to better protect the rights of American workers. And our nation must make it clear that the legal rights of women as citizens are guaranteed under the laws of our land by ratifying the Equal Rights Amendment.
The Equal Rights Amendment. A lot of the causes floated in the State of the Union speech become lost, if worthy causes. Hydrogen cars, trips to Mars, price controls, ending poverty, the deficit. Which may be why most presidents stick to the sober, boring, politically reliable economy. When Ronald Reagan was facing some pushback in the middle of a recession, he played some blame cards back in 1982.
Raise present taxes to cut future deficits, they tell us. Well, I don't believe we should buy that argument. There are too many imponderables for anyone to predict deficits or surpluses several years ahead with any degree of accuracy. The budget in place when I took office had been projected as balanced. It turned out to have one of the biggest deficits in history.
In hindsight, there's a lot of irony and tragedy here. Here's President George H.W. Bush dealing with his own financial meltdown in 1992.
For the untold number of hard-working, responsible American workers and businessmen and women who've been forced to go without needed bank loans, the banking credit crunch must end.
And of course, nobody gave more State of the Union addresses than FDR. This is from his eighth.
We should bring more citizens under the coverage of old age pensions and unemployment insurance. We should widen the opportunity for adequate medical care.
That call for pensions and medical care eventually became Social Security and Medicare. So Obama takes the podium tonight and will deliver his own mix of themes, calls to action, and for sacrifice. There will be causes and blame, rallying and applause lines, and then the speech will be put away in the drawer of history. And that messy governing business will resume. After you watch the speech, tell us what you think of it. Compare it to past presidents or anything else at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. And coming up in just a few minutes, Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty will answer the question on whether he's not running again for governor because he wants the chance to give his own State of the Union speech as president eventually. But first, let's check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. The president gives his first State of the Union address tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern. We'll get a reaction from General David Petraeus tomorrow. And in just a few minutes, like I said, we'll talk with Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty. But we're asking, what do you think? Maybe your State of the Union is really a message for the president.
Max from Florence, Alabama. Stop corporations from running this country.
Let us know your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post on our site, thetakeaway.org. And that's the place to go to give us your thoughts on the State of the Union speech after you've heard it. During tonight's speech, aides say the president will take responsibility, though not blame, for the unfulfilled promises made during his campaign. Among other things, he's expected to outline a change in how federal student loans are financed and a government spending freeze to reduce the national debt. White House employees are also feeling the pinch. The president's top aides will be subject to a salary freeze for the second year in a row.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton will attend 2 days of international conferences in London. Today will focus on ways to stop Yemen's role as a terror incubator. Tomorrow, leaders will concentrate on Afghanistan. And President Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan says he wants to reach out to Taliban leaders.
They have to be reintegrated, and they're welcome to be reintegrated.
Today, some U.S. officials said they would support that effort. It's the first day at the World Economic Forum in Davos, the Alpine Resort. Leaders from business, politics, and even art are gathering to talk about everything from international economic recovery to aid for earthquake victims in Haiti. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
The State of the Union.
The State of our Union.
State of the Union.
My fellow Americans, the State of our Union is
going to be fine.
Very, very public.
A complete disaster.
A little more honest.
Business as usual.
All this week, we're going to thinkers, writers, movers, and shakers in our State of the Union series. President Obama will lay out his agenda in the address to the American people tonight. And this morning, we're joined by Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty for his thoughts on the State of the Union. Good morning, Governor.
Good morning.
So one of the things that you have said frequently is that you feel the push for health care reform is a distraction from the country's real problems and that you feel Congress should instead focus on jobs and the economy. Well, it sounds like that's what President Obama is planning to do tonight with his State of the Union speech. And I'm wondering, do you have thoughts on what you might want to hear from him?
Yes. And so let's just jumping back for a second to health care. Of course, health care is a huge issue, but it's a cost crisis. And what the Democrats in Washington did is push it as an access issue. And so controlling costs would have been a better way to do that. There were some good bipartisan opportunities to do that, and President Obama took a different path. But clearly the jobs and the economy are the number one issue. I think you need to answer the question of what would grow more jobs in this country. We should ask the job providers. And when you ask them, what they say is, don't have the federal government suck all the financial oxygen out of the room, reduce spending, don't increase it, cut taxes, don't increase them. Do health care reform, but do it with market principles in mind and cost containment in mind, as opposed to just expanding a broken system, and try to do things that will put cash and resources into small and medium-sized and entrepreneurial stage businesses, like, you know, cut the payroll tax for employers and employees. Those are some examples, but his focus has been elsewhere, largely on the health care issue, and I think people have just said, you know, enough with the out-of-control spending and misdirected focus.
Well, you know, those are all great words of advice, but Republican Governor Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota, you have yourself found that to be a very difficult thing to do in your own state. For 2011, they're projecting a $4.4 billion deficit in Minnesota.
Well, we have a balanced budget requirement in Minnesota. Currently, our deficit is $1 billion, and 48 out of 50 states have same or similar budget crises just because our revenues have gone down. But our budgets will actually be balanced because they have to be, and that's why I think the federal government should do the same thing. In fact, I've called for a federal constitutional amendment, so the federal government has to do what we do. There's no question that states have red ink, but the only difference between us and the federal government is we actually have to solve ours.
Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty, in your state is the Mayo Clinic. I'm sure you're familiar with it, right?
Very familiar, yes. We're very proud of it.
And, of course, some of the buildings at the Mayo Clinic were built and financed by foreign leaders, particularly Saudi sheikhs who come there for all kinds of procedures. Under what circumstances, if cost containment could get under control, would you expand access so that everyone in the state of Minnesota could have access to the care at the Mayo Clinic?
Yeah, I think the way to expand access would be to give individuals or people who are not able to afford health care at market rates, you know, a tax credit or a voucher so that they could go into the marketplace with good information about price and quality and financial incentives to use the system wisely, but they would be, you know, given some assistance through the form of an individually based tax credit or voucher. That would keep marketplace principles in mind. And the heart of healthcare reform needs to be this. People spend their money differently if some of it is their own. And so if you give consumers good information about price and quality and financial incentives to use the system wisely, they generally do. So for people who can function in a marketplace, I think that's the heart of the reform. And we have to stop paying for volumes of procedure and start paying for healthcare quality. The Mayo Clinic and others in Minnesota have done that with great success.
For the State of the Union address that President Obama will be delivering tonight, we've gotten a few hints on what he'll be talking about, and we certainly have heard a lot about some of his middle class initiatives coming from the middle class task force. And I'm wondering what you think about some of these ideas that he has in terms of helping out the middle class, which has been struggling during this recession.
Yeah, of course, we'll see the details tonight. A lot of it is in kind of leaked or very generalized news reports. But anything that he can do that would be in the direction of lowering government intrusion in the marketplace, trying to do things to incentivize investment, business growth, business startups, adding jobs, you know, doing that with hopefully some awareness of how private markets work and some appreciation and respect for private enterprise, those could potentially be steps in the right direction. We'll have to wait to see the details. It's probably a little late in the sense that we wish we had been doing some of those things earlier, but at least he's now admitting that you can't just spend your way to prosperity, and he's going to have to do some things to try to stimulate a private sector growth, not just government growth.
Governor Pawlenty of Minnesota, I got to say, the idea of less government intrusion in the marketplace in light of the economic crash and what went on at AIG and many of the banks, that can't be a popular message among many of your constituents.
Well, the message we're trying to convey is this, if for every increment that the government takes out of the private sector, it extracts or discourages private sector activity. So, if the government takes a dollar from you, Celeste, in taxes, it brings it into the government system, takes, 5% to whatever in overhead and then redistributes in political parties. The government doesn't create wealth. It just extracts it from the private economy and redistributes it in for other uses. So keep in mind this stimulus approach. They said if you don't pass the stimulus bill, we're going to have 8% unemployment. Then, well, we have 10% unemployment. It really hasn't worked. And so clearly there's been bad behavior by some of our businesses, and we need to have new frameworks in place to try to better regulate in a more modern way some of that activity. But I'm talking about when you send a message to this market that at the end of 2010 you're not going to extend the Bush tax cuts and marginal income tax rates are going to go up and capital gains tax rates are going to go up and we're going to have other financial burdens in terms of just crushing debt that the federal government is incurring because of their spending binge, that's going to usurp capital and energy and activity and entrepreneurial spirit in the private market in ways that are not going to be helpful to job growth.
Minnesota Governor, hold on a second. I-35, which runs through your city there in the Twin Cities and your state, was financed wholly by the federal government, and it creates wealth as infrastructure in your state. What do you mean the government doesn't create wealth?
Well, if you look at it from a macroeconomic standpoint, highways and public safety and lots of other things that government does is important. But when you take a dollar into government, you're taking it from somebody or something in the private sector. So that dollar would have been otherwise deployed, spent, circulated in the economy. We're taking it from that use into a government use, and so it just changes the priority and the use of the money, but it's not a net increase in economic activity.
I would say Target is taking my private dollars and doing what they will with those profits too, but that's an economic debate that is an interesting one for another time. I really want to talk about the State of the Union.
Well, but just on your example, you choose voluntarily in a market to go to Target.
Right.
And Target then takes your dollar and conducts other activities in the private sector. Again, I'm not saying government doesn't do important things. I'm just saying you have to understand macroeconomics. And when you spend government money, it just doesn't fall from the tree. It gets extracted from another part of the economy.
So let me ask you to do an important thing for us, Tim Pawlenty. The first is answer yes or no. Are you planning to run for president in 2012?
I don't know what I'm going to be doing after I'm governor at the end of this year, but I'm certainly going to speak to these issues as best I can to help my party and Republicans across the country.
Okay. Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty, a Republican elected in 2002, not seeking re-election in 2010. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Tomorrow, as part of our series this week, we're going to ask General David Petraeus for his take on the State of the Union, and particularly the unions he's responsible for, the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. And Ian on our site has his own State of the Union in six words or less. Obama has squandered the public's trust. Paul from Livermore, California says, we're so screwed, oh, so screwed. You know how to reach us.
877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post it on thetakeaway.org. That's also where we want you to give us your thoughts on the State of the Union speech after you hear it tonight. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.